Well, good afternoon. This is Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy, your host. And today, our topic is Peter Dunlap-Scholl. He's here to talk with us today, and it's a great privilege to have him. Peter and I go way back. We were in the, class of 81 that got swept into the Anchorage Daily News many years ago. Pete grew up in Alaska. He lived through the 1964 earthquake and has also done an animation on that. He went away to Whitman to go to college, but he came back and he went to work at his hometown newspaper as a cartoonist. And he labored there mightily for more than 25 years. But in 2002, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's, stayed on at the paper for another 6 years or so, and eventually left the paper. But that departure might have been from one public platform, but it's not the end of Pete's story. It's the beginning of a new chapter of a very engaged Peter Dunlap-Scholl. And we are really privileged to hear from you, Pete. So welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Thank you for having me.
It's our treat. I want to let callers know that they can participate in this conversation if they'd like to. It's you can email us at hometownalaska@kska.org. You can also call us at 550-8433 or statewide 1-888-353-5752. And I always like to point out that at the kska.org website, things that we talk about on the show, those links and URLs are on kska.org. So in Pete's case, there's an awful lot to point to. We focused on his Parkinson's blog off and on again, and his own personal blog, The Frozen Grin. So the links are on our site, and there's also a link, actually the video of Pete describing what it's like to have Parkinson's disease. That's on our website as well. So invite you to be sure to check out the website. And also let you know that this program is recorded and it will air again tonight at 7 o'clock. But now's the only time for folks to call in if that's what they want to do. So, Peter, welcome to Hometown Alaska. Thank you for taking the time out to be with us.
It's nice to be in hometown, in my hometown.
At home in your hometown.
Yep.
There you go. So let's get started. I think the beginning of the story would be the diagnosis. And can you can you relive that a little bit for us?
Well, it was kind of eerie because I had this problem, a tremor in my left leg. And I knew it was possibly something bad, but I didn't know it was Parkinson's. And I hoped it wasn't that. Convinced myself that it was actually an ergonomic problem. So I went to see a doctor of physical medicine, and he looked at it. And before I went in, I had to write a description of what was wrong. And I wrote this classic description of Parkinson's disease. It was like everything that you have when you're looking for Parkinson's disease, I wrote down there. It was like tremor predominantly on one side, a tremor that was a resting tremor, slowness of movement, difficulty swallowing, all this stuff. And I wrote it all down. So when he got this, he was pretty alert because a lot of people are not used to seeing Parkinson's in younger people.
How old were you?
I was 43, I think.
So that's very young for Parkinson's.
Yeah, it's quite unusual for that to happen. That's one reason that it's not often caught very well, but he caught it. And he said, well, I think you got Parkinson's disease. Let me just go get the manual and I'll show you the manual.
The diagnostic manual?
The diagnostic manual. He brought this huge book out and he put it on Parkinson's disease and it was bang, 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 bang. Every symptom was right, something I had. And after, as my mind went from symptom to symptom, I just was more and more convinced that that's what I had. I didn't have much time for denial, which I suppose I probably had before I went there. It was when I went through my denial phase. But when he just handed me that book, it was obvious that I had Parkinson's disease. I didn't know what that meant, but I knew it was not good.
And so was it like the world descending on you, or did you just kind of drift around in a fog for a while trying to understand?
Well,
we should tell people what Parkinson's is.
Okay. What Parkinson's is a part of your brain very slowly ceases to work. It's the part that is responsible for your ability to initiate voluntary movement, as well as a lot of other things. And one of the things about Parkinson's that people don't understand is that it's actually in every cell of your body. It's way more complex than just a brain disease, but it is at least a brain disease. And the most prominent symptoms are this. You lose the ability to, well, as I asked the guy, I said, well, I lose small motor coordination, then what? He goes, big coordination. It's like over time you lose basically everything you do that makes you who you are in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
Your ability to talk, your ability to, in my case, to draw or to speak or to interact. Over time, it will be taken away by Parkinson's disease.
So this was 2002. You're sitting in the doctor's office.
Yep.
And what's going through your head?
Well, actually, mostly it was just these questions. But when I came out, I had this sort of weird experience. It was like something you read in a spiritual book of some kind, where this voice spoke to me, and it spoke without words, but it said, you have to exercise, because if you do not exercise, you go down in a rapid downward spiral that will be much steeper than it would be otherwise. And I've come to think of this as the visitation of the spandex angel. And it's been interesting to me, because since the spandex angel came and talked to me, there have been a lot of studies about exercise and how important it is in Parkinson's and how it may actually slow it down. And there's a lot of studies in mice, and I often say, well, that's another one for the mice. If they had Parkinson's, it'd be no problem. There's lots of cures for mice, but there's nothing for people.
Yes.
So, yeah. There are lots of things that can modify your symptoms at this point. So I should say there's not nothing, but anyway, there's evidence from the mice and the rats that exercise will, in fact, rebuild some of your lost nerve cells. And it's not clear if they're dead or if they're just lying low, I guess, is one of the things one of the many mysteries of Parkinson's.
So this was very early on. You had this sort of this wisdom come to you.
It was like, it was an urgent situation, and I think the urgent part of your brain, like, that still works. The part that you don't really think with, but the part that reacts, gets on this kind of stuff and says, well, we've got a code red here, what do we do? And it says, it just produces these intense moments for you that will help you survive, I think.
So at 2002, you were still working full-time at the Anchorage Daily News. You were part of the editorial board. You were drawing, how many cartoons?
I was drawing 10 a week because I was doing a strip then as well.
Yeah. And you weren't starting in on animation yet then. You were
No, those come later.
A pencil guy.
Yep, I was pen ink guy.
Pen and ink guy.
19th century sort of approach to what I was doing.
And life went on for a while?
Yeah, because at that point, one thing about Parkinson's is very slow, usually in its onset. And it's the sort of thing where it came on so slowly that my wife didn't even really notice it. It was relatives that would say, what's wrong with Pete? How come he looks like an old man? How come he moves like an old man? My sister, who lives in New York City, said, she took my wife aside and said, what's with Peter? He seems like one of those street people you see on the subway.
Oh.
It's kind of scary when people put it that way.
Yes.
You can imagine, in fact, if you didn't have a good support system or decent insurance, that you would easily be one of those people. It's not hard to imagine at all. And you might not even know what's wrong with you at that point, because you wouldn't have a good person to go to diagnose you.
Right. So, in other words, you know, even though the symptoms were visible, you weren't aware, your wife wasn't aware.
No.
But now you get the diagnosis, and how does life change then?
Well, life totally changes, because for one thing, you think that you're going to be a bent over, drooling, stooped, shaky person pretty soon, and that's...
Like by next Tuesday.
Yeah, that's what you think. Or it doesn't matter when it's going to happen. It's like, that's your fate eventually, so... Life sort of turns to ash in front of you is what it does.
Yeah. What did you do? I mean, first of all, you have to find doctors. You have to start
Well,
treatment.
One of the first things I did was get a confirmation diagnosis by going to Seattle and seeing somebody that was actually a movement disorder specialist, which is what you need to see if you're a person that has Parkinson's. Because the local doctors are pretty competent, I would say. But to be really informed about something as complicated as Parkinson's disease, you really need to get special training. And that's one of the things that... There's like different varieties of Parkinson's disease, some of which are very nasty, and which it's good if you can get those either diagnosed or ruled out.
And
so
I
did that.
You did that.
Yeah. What? Sort of a grand tradition of flying outside for medical help, which goes way back in the state, because people have always had to, when things get complicated, they had to go somewhere else. So that's sort of, I felt like I was part of Alaska history in a way in that.
So you went down and you figured out what kind of Parkinson's you have. What kind do you
have? It's young onset, because I'm still actually, I think the average age onset is 50, which I'm now 52. But it's young onset, but it seems to be idiopathic. In other words, it's just, they don't know where it comes from is what that means.
Idiopathic.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And there are familial types of Parkinson's disease, but they are in well-defined families, and the number of them in the universe of Parkinson's is very small.
Now, at the newspaper where you were primarily the cartoonist, political cartoonist, and editorial board member, you're still drawing, or are you finding it more and more difficult to draw?
Well, I've always found it difficult to draw, actually. That's one of the things that's been great about it, is that it's something to master there, but it was before I even knew I had Parkinson's, I was having lots of problems drawing because I was having repetitive strains, which were, I think, complicated by the stiffness of Parkinson's. One of the things that makes your muscles all stiff. And I would have these awful pains. And in fact, it was so painful that even though I really wanted to draw, I loved drawing more than anything, it was getting to the point where I couldn't draw. And I went to see my doctor, the same guy that I thought I would see for the ergonomic problem. He's a bright guy. And he kept me going for a while, but then he finally got to a point where he said, I can't think of anything that'll keep you drawing at this point. And that was a very big blow to me because that was my identity for a very long time. I've always been the guy that was like drawing little pictures and amusing his friends. That's
sort of what I've done. Way back to elementary school.
Yeah, from elementary school up to the very last day I worked at the Daily News. That's what I did. So, and what I continue to do, actually. But I knew something that he didn't know, and that was that there are these little drawing tablets, which is that you can draw on electronically. And that was the sort of thing where you could put it into a posture with your body that was ergonomically acceptable. And that was different than my usual way of drawing, which was like to hang over and clutch things and do all this stuff. So I had a lot of bad ergonomic practices, but they wouldn't have been a problem except for Parkinson's. But it finally got to the point where I had to switch to this pad. And that turned out to be a great thing because when I switched to the pad, I was hell-bent on recreating my old style, which was this sort of 1970 version of cartooning, and was, in fact, after doing it for 20 years, it was time to move on, but I didn't realize that at the time. I was busy recreating my old style, and I finally got there. It was a perfect...
On the computer.
You couldn't tell it was drawn with a guy working on a computer, and I got that then, I looked at it, and it seemed to look back at me, and it said, it's really a good waste of time there. You've gone and taken a $150 or $1,500 computer and like a $900 software program and turned it into a 50-cent pen. And it was like, why did I do that? That was like all that labor wasted. Because there's so many things you can do on the computer, the textures and the colors and all the stuff, which are very easy to translate to the printing press. And that was like, oh, man, I was very exasperated with myself at that point.
But since then, it actually
unleashed an amazing amount of creativity because the computer is up until then it had been sort of an impediment for me and for other people, but it suddenly became a tool, which was like a Swiss Army knife with about 7,000 blades on it. It was all the things you could do with it, including animation, which I have always wanted to do, but which you normally have to outsource to Korea, which I don't have the resources to do that now, but now I just outsource it to my computer and it's all taken care of that way.
So basically, once you sort of recreated your pen and ink style, mm-hmm. you looked at it, abandoned it, and yep. moved on. And where did you move to?
Well, I started using all the different tools and textures that it can use. And so I was still creating static drawings at that point. But then I realized that, it became clear that we're going to have to do more at the paper than just do the old thing we've been doing forever and ever.
Yeah, that's by then the newspaper was online and they were looking for a different kind of multimedia.
Right, and I was trying to find ways to engage people online. And I did come up with this Name That Tune thing, which was one way we did that. It was one of the first things that we did that was interactive at the paper.
And that was
fun. That was where I would draw a cartoon and let people write captions for it. And it was a good experiment, I think, but I think we had kind of too small a pool of people. Because the good people would always win it. And it got to be kind of frustrating for people that weren't that good. And I didn't want to pick stuff that wasn't good. So it was like automatically some people got excluded. And that was sort of about the time I bowed out from the paper, it was time to close it down anyways. That was
I just good. Want to tell our listeners, if they're just tuning in right now, this is Hometown Alaska. And you're listening to Peter Dunlap Scholl, who's our guest today, talking about living with Parkinson's and the doors that closes and the doors that opens. If you're interested in participating in our conversation, you can call us at 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752 or send us an email to hometownalaska@kska.org. And anyway, back to you, Pete. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but... Mm-hmm. Basically, you're still working, but eventually you left the paper. You started animations. I remember Joe Contraire, mm-hmm. who was a cantankerous character who would criticize the Anchorgillians.
Right.
He was animated.
Yep. We were too cheap to hire an ombudsman, but fortunately, many people were willing to criticize us for free was the idea with Joe Contraire.
Uh-huh. And I'm not sure what else you did, but eventually 2006 rolls around. You're still working full time, but you took a buyout then.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what were your thoughts then? Were you thinking, wow, this is the end of my newspaper career?
Well,
or?
I was sure that was the end of my newspaper career because the number of people that were getting the gate at that point from the profession were just, I think, maybe 13 people lost their job the same year I did.
And these are cartoonists?
Yes.
Or people at the Anchorage Daily
13
News.
Cartoonists.
Yeah, so basically newspapers were finding they couldn't afford cartoonists anymore.
And I was actually at a point where it was very difficult for me to draw, even with medications and stuff, because you either can't move if you have Parkinson's or you move too much. You get to a point where your brain can only handle so much of the medication, but you have to take a lot of it to get anywhere. So to achieve ignition, you got to take like X amount, and then at that point, when it starts to hit, you have all kinds of excess movement and stuff.
So it's very hard to control.
Yeah, I was like, for instance, I actually had this interesting experience where a person asked me to come and give a talk to the college, which was put online. And I watched that, and I was like, my head was in the frame like every 5 seconds. It was like, it would sort of pass through, and I was just moving so much that I had no idea it was moving that much. It was amazing to me.
Wow.
And trying to draw when you're doing all that is
difficult.
It's a good way to lose weight, I can tell you that. I lost like 20 pounds in that period.
Yeah, yeah. So was it something of a relief then to step away from that full time?
Actually, I guess it was, although I was
hard.
I'd always thought of myself as a political cartoonist since the days of Watergate when I'd been a cartoonist in training at that point. And it was, I thought it would be harder actually to say goodbye. It was not as hard as I thought it was because there's lots of opportunities to continue on the web with
other
comment.
Tools,
yep.
Yeah, and other formats.
And
yeah.
Plus, I was struggling full-time with Parkinson's at that point. So I was certainly occupied. I didn't have, like, time heavy on my hands.
Right, so...
Which is because I probably would have dropped it.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to go to the phones. We've got a caller.
Okay.
And Diane, welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Hi, Peter. I have a question regarding... the many topics that you drew on repeatedly over the years at ADN.
Mm-hmm.
And do you have any statistics on perhaps one topic that you may have drawn on more than others, or a few of them? I know that Town Square, it seems like you've been doing that since the 80s. And do you have any knowledge of which topic you actually drew on the most?
Oh, man, that's a good question. I don't, because I've done thousands, literally thousands of cartoons, and I've never had time to go back and look at all those. But I think I drew a ton on tobacco, for instance, the tobacco tax. And that was one that was really very fecund, and it was the sort of thing that there was no shortage of ways to approach it. It was really great.
You know, Pete, is this a good time to remind people that your work is in the museum?
Yeah, well, I guess yeah.
It's part of their permanent collection.
Right. It became clear to me that as much as the Daily News was a great place for me, it was not going to be the sort of place where people remembered much. And I had this vision of somebody like 5 years from now tripping over my work and saying, "What's this doing here? It's in the way. Let's get rid of it." So I just engineered the thing, and the news is very supportive of that. Where it was transferred to the museum, which was very happy to have it. They were, when cartoonists were being sort of let go all over the country, it was very comforting to have a place.
To know that it would be someplace.
Yeah, the attitude of the museum was, these are very rich documents.
It's great for Anchorage to know that your work is still accessible to them. It's in the permanent collection, not out on display, but at some point it could be.
Right, or it'll be there for scholars to look at and see what...
That's good to know. It would be nice to know if that's indexed or not.
They're working on that, but it's a lot of stuff to do, actually.
Yeah. Good. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Dan.
It's kind of a demented history of the city is what it is, and the state.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think I'm really glad that it's there, and I wanted people to know that. I've got another caller.
Okay.
Gene, welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Oh, hi there. Hi, Peter.
Hello.
I actually get your emails.
Oh, that's...
from the Parkinson's...
Oh, right, okay.
I'm 57. I was just diagnosed about 6 months ago. In fact, I'm not sure if it was early onset Parkinson.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been fairly relatively healthy my whole life.
Uh-huh.
Lay a little out of shape. But one thing I've had trouble with is the the medication. I've had to stop taking the medication during the day, but I can take it in the evening. But one thing I went and did, I was probably diagnosed. I had symptoms last December, and I was actually saw a doctor in July. But I bought a condo last month.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope I didn't make a big mistake.
Well, I would say that if you've just been recently diagnosed, there's lots you can do to take care of yourself and to sort of hold Parkinson's at bay. Although you have problems with the medication, you said? You're only able to take it at night?
It's generic Artane.
Uh-huh. So that's the first medication you start on is Artane?
Yeah.
Okay, well, so you've got lots of other possible medications to go to at this point. So I would say that you're probably in pretty good shape, and I would not feel bad at all about buying a condo now, because you're going to be able to take care of that. And if your case is managed well, you've got lots of great time ahead of you. And I have to say, when I was diagnosed, I thought the world was coming to an end. But what I've realized 8 years along is that Parkinson's is kind of like a lot of other things. It's just everybody's got something they've got to drag around. And in our case, it's Parkinson's. But at least we know what it is. We can treat it and work with it.
Well, so far, the only symptom I have is my right arm. I have resting tremors.
Uh-huh.
And that's pretty much the only symptom. And that's kind of annoying, but when I'm busy, it was interesting. When I first got your emails, I didn't know what you did. Now I do.
Oh.
But I do a lot of CAD drafting. I do architectural design.
Uh-huh.
Or furniture design. But the one time that the tremors don't bother me is when I'm working.
Oh, that's interesting.
That is interesting.
A lot of stuff on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the computer's been a real boon to me, and it's probably sort of thing where I had to use it to adapt to my problems I had. It's a flexible tool that will, I think, you'll be able to work for quite a long time, is my guess.
It's pretty inspiring, isn't it, Gene, to have Peter to talk to?
Oh, yeah. Well, I've been meaning to go to the support groups, but about the time that I found out about the support group, I got busy with this condo move, so when I settled down.
Well, here's one thing. We're having a group meeting actually this Saturday at the Pioneer Home at 3:30. So if anybody out there wants to come down and participate, they're certainly welcome.
So thanks,
okay,
Gene.
Thank you, and I look forward to meeting you, Peter.
I look forward to meeting you. Thank you very much for calling in.
Thank you.
So I actually wanted to go to a topic that I think you and I talked about it in advance. The fact that this is such a scary and mm-hmm. dramatic disease leads to depression.
Yep.
And in your case, it led to depression. I'd like you to talk about how you handled it, how you see it now.
Well, it's a very potent topic because at any time over the course of their illness, like 40% of people that have Parkinson's will have depression, 40 to 50%. Nobody knows for sure because people are not able to keep statistics very accurately about Parkinson's because it's often misdiagnosed, et cetera. But a lot of people will have depression, and I certainly had depression. There's sort of situational depression, and there's medical depression. And situational depression is when you're depressed about external things that are bothering you. And I had that to start with. I, in fact, was to the point where I thought about just sort of ending it all, as they say, or committing suicide. Because I didn't want to be a person that didn't draw anymore, couldn't interact with the family, couldn't do all this stuff. And my wife was great. She asked me this, if I was thinking about that, and I said, well, actually, I am. And she said, well, you're not allowed to do that. That is not something you can do. And I said, oh, well, all right, if that's the way it's going to be, I'll reserve that for later. But we won't do it now. And that was one of the few good decisions I made in the heat of the diagnosis. The disease is slow, as we said before. And I have to say that this period of my life has been incredibly rich because, for one thing, getting treated with the medication sort of brought me back creatively in some ways. I had been on a creative role unlike anything I've ever experienced before. And I don't know if that's my natural creativity now that's been brought back because the Parkinson's isn't holding it back anymore, or if that was like all this pent-up creativity that I had that Parkinson's just released, or if it might be a reaction to the idea that my time is short and I got to get going while I can. But it's been a wild ride. I've been animating. I've turned stuff into the Anchorage Film Festival, which is been very good to me, and it's been very exciting to have that outlet and stuff. And
Well, before we leave the topic of depression, I just want to sort of you know, you've written about this, about don't let pride get in the way. Don't, yep. You know, if you need help, get help. What kind of help did you get? Did you go to specifically to somebody? I mean, how did that work?
I actually talked to my doctor about it, and he said, I guess we could probably give you some pills for that. And it was pretty much that simple. I had this particular form of depression called emotional incontinence, which is a very interesting phrase, incontinence.
Emotional incontinence.
And that is when you become overwhelmed by stuff that shouldn't overwhelm you. It's like your response is all out of scale to what it should be. For instance, I would talk to my son about Jimi Hendrix, and I think Hendrix is a great guitar player, et cetera, but I'm not all that hooked into his music. But because I had this emotional incontinence, I would just blather all over the place and get all choked up and sniffle stuff. It's like I couldn't hold a simple conversation. So at that point, it was time to get treatment, because there was going to be a point when I couldn't talk about anything. It was clear to me that I was progressing that way. So I did get that. And that is one of the things that a big problem for my fellow men in the support group is that we don't like to talk about our emotions or even admit that we have them. It's hard for us to come to grips with Parkinson's. I've seen this with a lot of people. They just won't admit that they have a problem with depression. It's one of the things that's harder to deal with. And I've read that this is one of the worst symptoms, because it's so hard to deal with, because people have to, at some point, admit that they're depressed, that it is bringing down their quality of life, and there is something they can do about it.
And so you got medication. I'm just trying to figure out if that was such a relief that, you know, the creativity took over, wherever that came from.
Well,
that also lifted your spirits.
Creativity came before the medication, a long time. It was, I think, just the basic Parkinson's medications, the ones for your average symptoms. Which may have been that I had increased dexterity, too, and it was just easier to push the pencil around or the pen.
Mm-hmm.
But
So your creativity came, the surge came first,
yep.
The depression came. Did it make you avoid work, depression, or did it, how did it, well, the emotional incontinence
was,
we talked
yeah,
about.
Yeah, that's what I would have.
That was pretty much how it manifested?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So now, are you still taking medication for depression, or have you worked your way out of that?
Well, I still take it, actually. And I think that I have a very hard time talking about Parkinson's right now, because I'd be like sniveling and choking up on the radio. And that would not be a very good interview, I think.
I see. So it continues, but it's treated now.
Yes.
So do you find that it's Parkinson's people don't really like to talk about the depression side of it?
The men, for sure. But it's one of the things there's a lot of motor symptoms, and there's the non-motor symptoms. They're just now really sort of starting to concentrate more on the non-motor symptoms, because
being depression being one of them.
Yeah, it's just been such a priority to deal with the problem that you have when you can't move, that these other things have been sort of, the finer points have been left.
Right.
But they're starting to get to them now. It's one of the things that they're working on.
Well, Peter, we're going to take a little break, but I want to let folks know in the second half hour, we're going to talk about deep brain stimulation, which is something you went to mediate your symptoms, and
right.
Like to know how that's doing.
Okay.
We're going to talk some more about your creativity and what you're up to right now. And I'm hoping at the end of the half hour, we might just hear a little bit from you on politics in Alaska, which is never a dull subject.
Right.
This is Kathleen McCoy. You're listening to Hometown Alaska.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Hometown Alaska on KSKA, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. A copy of Hometown Alaska will be available this afternoon on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Hello, this is Kathleen McCoy. Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. This afternoon, we're talking with Peter Dunlap-Scholl, longtime political cartoonist in Alaska, commenting on statewide politics. A couple years ago, he left the Anchorage Daily News, but that was not the end of Peter's commentary. I'd like to invite you to participate in this conversation if you'd like to. It's 550-8433 if you'd like to give a call, or 1-888-353-5752. That's our statewide number. And you can email us at hometownalaska@kska.org. Pete, welcome back. And
thank you.
That was a powerful first half hour. Thank you. I would like to talk now a little bit about, I just saw a video of you giving a talk to Parkinson's a conference, and it was the HOPE conference. It was down in Seattle, and you touched on some things there. One of the first ones was learn to adapt, and let's talk a little bit about that, because that's really been your story since diagnosis.
Okay, well, I think that I put that as the first. I have like 9 ingredients for homemade HOPE is what the speech was about. And I put that as the first ingredient because there's so much you can do to adapt if you will think creatively about your disease. We talked a lot about drawing. I'll talk a little bit about music, which was one thing I was very attached to. And one of the most frustrating things about Parkinson's was the loss of the ability to play the guitar. It was a huge outlet for me for years and years and years, very fulfilling. And then my Parkinson's dominates my left-hand side, which is my fingering side of my guitar. And I got to the point where my digits wouldn't move. They'd just be glued to the fretboard is what it seemed like. So I decided I'd try to learn slide guitar because you hold basically a bar in your hand. You don't have to do all the fingering. And that was actually very stimulating because you have to think about the guitar differently then. And so I found all kinds of stuff I'd never noticed before about the guitar. It was really very cool because you have to think more efficiently about how you're going to create your lines and stuff because you don't have all those fingers. And so that was an example of what you can do to adapt.
You still play?
I still do play, yes.
And by the way, I wanted to tell you, Pete, Tom Walforth just sent in a question right to this point.
Okay.
He says, Pete, I enjoy your mandolin and dobro playing. Can music playing be therapeutic? And would you recommend that folks that have just been diagnosed with Parkinson's pick up an instrument?
Well, this is a whole field that is very ripe for exploration because they found that, for instance, dancing the tango is very good for Parkinson's.
Tango is good for Parkinson's.
I can get a rose and stick it in my teeth and dance a tango is what I need to do. It's a
that music. The spandex angel.
Yeah, I'll dance with the spandex angel. So yeah. We'll go into a dip, and I hope I won't drop the angel at that point. That would be a big mistake, I think.
Yeah, so there's a lot of research around music.
Yes, there is, and they found that people can do task synchronized music, and as you speed the music up, they'll speed up their tasks so that they're ordinarily very slow, but with music, people can actually move. Some people, not all people, but some people can find that with music, they can use it to cue from, and they're able to move. There's dramatic. If you Google Parkinson's and music on the web, you'll come up with a video that shows a guy who is very Parkinsonian, shuffling and slow moving, turns on his radio, and he starts dancing all around his apartment. It's quite interesting.
Wow. You know, we're going to go to the phones because we have a question about music from Tony. Hello.
Hi. I was going to ask basically the same question that Mr. Walforth brought up online, but I have also really enjoyed Pete's dobro and mandolin playing up close and personal several times. And would like to hear him comment some more on what how music has affected his Parkinson's treatment and therapy.
Okay, Tony, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, one thing that I did do, and this is another example of adapting, is I went to the mandolin, and that was partly for the reason that I was in a band and still am, a fine band called Whiskey Jacks. Got to plug them now. I've got to plug all this stuff I'm doing because...
Why not?
Yeah, why not? It's what the radio's for, right?
That's
what I'm getting out of this.
Let the world know what's happening.
The thing about the mandolin is that it fit better in our band because we had lots of guitars, and for me to add another guitar to that was like, it sort of bulks up the mid-range and you can't hear anything. So I went to the mandolin, which is a very high range. But the other thing about it is frets are closer together, so I didn't have to make the big stretches that I had to make to play the guitar. So it was actually another way of adapting that was very helpful to me because I was able to carve out a new niche for myself that I would never have been that interested in if it hadn't been for Parkinson's.
Right.
And the same is true of, I would say, one of the things I had to do is there came a point where the Parkinson's support group in town was looking for somebody to run it, and I did not want to do that. It was not my idea of a good time, like organizing things and making people show up and stuff like that. I didn't want to be responsible for
other
people.
You're not a good den mother.
No, but I had this, it's similar to Spandex Angel in some ways. I had this, it was very clear to me what I had to do to make the group better. So I was able to step into that. And when I did it, it was very painful in a lot of ways because I did not like organizing things. But at the same time, I got a tremendous boost out of making information available to people, which is, I think, one of the big things that hold people back about Parkinson's is finding out what they can do to deal with it. And there's some things that are very efficacious if you just know what they are. For instance, speech therapy. I wouldn't be able to talk right now if it wasn't for my speech therapist. And
did you start that right away?
Well, I'll tell you a story about that, Kathleen, because I was reluctant to go to the meetings of the support group because I didn't want to encounter what I call the scary old guy with Parkinson's. And this was not any particular person. This was just a guy in my mind who represented my future, a guy that was bent over, shaking, drooling. And so I didn't go to the meetings for a long time. But then this meeting came up that was so interesting, I had to go. And it was not only interesting to me, it was interesting to a ton of people. So there was nowhere to sit but one seat next to a scary old guy with Parkinson's. So I had to go down and sit next to this guy. And I've been avoiding him, but he did not avoid me. He just leaned right over and said, "Ugh." I said, "I'm sorry, I didn't catch that. What was that?" He leaned over again and he said, "Ugh." And this went on for a while, and finally his wife intervened. And she said, "He said, don't wait to get speech therapy," which was, I didn't wait.
Apparently not.
No.
So another message.
Huh. Yep, and that sort of the interesting thing about that is you're never so far gone that you can't help somebody else, I guess. And this guy was still trying, even though he couldn't talk. I can imagine how frustrating it was for him to have this guy say, this young guy who he knew had Parkinson's, but apparently was doing much better at that point because that was early on in my diagnosis. And he was trying to tell this to me, and I was not getting it. It's been terribly frustrating for him. Right. And bless his wife for intervening and seeing that. And that was, we were both relieved at that point.
So, I mean, that was one of those, almost like the spandex angel, this idea that helping people is something that's going to help you, or?
Well, that wasn't so much a spandex angel moment as just sort of drawing an obvious conclusion from life where the guy was so far gone, but he was still trying to help other people. That was, I thought, very impressive and sort of heroic
pretty
in
moving.
A kind of way. Yeah.
Yeah, heroic. Yeah, yeah. I'm going to take a question we got, Pete, on from email. This is from Ann Pitts, and she writes, "My parents are moving here from Colorado mm-hmm. in 2 weeks. My father, 74, has Parkinson's. He was diagnosed about 5 years ago. It seems to be advancing quickly. Are there resources such as a physician, part-time caregiver, et cetera, to help us care for him? He's also blind, a different disease. Your use of the computer intrigues me. Is there a way to adapt it for use for the blind?" So there's really two questions there. I'm not sure people do know about the group that you lead. So maybe we can help Anne a little bit by talking how to connect up with that.
Well, I would, for sure say that you should probably get in touch with me and come to one of our meetings. My number is 350-9691, and that is my cell phone number. So there's no chance I won't answer it eventually if you leave a message. And the thing is that we do have meetings, and this is a great time to talk because it's not just me at this meeting. It's just like everybody that's there has something that they can tell you about Parkinson's. We've got like 300 years probably aggregated Parkinson's experience in that room. So if you've got a problem, it's a chance that somebody else has had that and has found a solution or a modus vivendi, a way of living with it. So that's one thing I would say was a great resource. Another is that we do have a visiting movement disorders doc who comes up about four times a year, and he is with the Frank Ellenson's practice over at Providence. So this guy is a fellowship trained movement disorders doctor.
Yes. Doctor. What's his name, Pete?
That's Dr. Alec Glass.
Coming from where?
San Francisco is where he comes from. And this is an amazing thing because we haven't had a specialist until recently. And it's great for him because he's able to actually help people in a way he can't in San Francisco because there's lots of expertise down there. But there's not as much expertise in the finer points up here. So he can do stuff where he can really help people. So it's good for him. And it's great for us.
And as a movement specialist, is he combining medication and deep brain stimulation? I mean, is that what he's calibrating for different patients?
Well, he's the person that is qualified to be a sort of a gatekeeper for deep brain stimulation, which is surgery for Parkinson's. And he is a neurologist, so he's not a neurosurgeon, so he doesn't do the operation himself, but he does, as part of a team, help evaluate people for it and can be a person that flags for you if the surgery will be a good option for you.
I see. And there was one other outstanding question with Anne about adaptations for blindness. I'm not sure you're...
Well, I don't know. I haven't been blind myself, but I do know that, for instance, there's a speech recognition program for computers called Dragon, which you can actually dictate into this. It will recognize your voice over time, and I don't know how well her father speaks now because he's probably had impacts on his speech just as I have from the disease, but it's supposed to recognize your speech and develop the ability to deal with your personal speech over time. So I was just, that is one thing that she should look at.
And there's certainly programs that can read web pages for you.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Well, we've started on the deep brain stimulation. Let's go there.
Okay.
Tell me how you were selected for that. What were the criteria?
Well, it's if you're, one of the basic rules of thumb is if you respond well to levodopa, which is the sort of the gold standard treatment of Parkinson's, you'll probably be a good candidate for this. But you need to be in fairly good shape, not have any dementia or anything like that, because they find that if they implant a person with this gizmo, it doesn't really help that much.
They have dementia.
They're not able to take care of it and do the various things you have to do to adjust to it. And so for idiopathic Parkinson's, which I have, if you're in good health otherwise, they will agree to consider drilling a hole in your head and running a wire into your brain. So that's the good news, I guess.
That's the good news.
Yep. And the other good news is that this seems to, some people are so well affected by this that they don't have to take medication anymore. And it's been significant for me. Although one thing I didn't realize is that a lot of the efficaciousness comes in with the adjustment of the device over time. So I thought I would be plugged in and everything would be groovy, but it actually takes you a while to sort of balance your medication against the amount of stimulation and to make sure that you have the right to... What happens is you have these two wires that are basically inserted into your head because you have... Your brain is symmetrical and has the same organelles or organs on either side. So you have these two places in your head where you're deficient, and it will run a current into this place. And for reasons they don't understand, you suddenly have the ability to move. And one of the things is they do this for you while you're awake.
You're kidding.
No, you're being operated on, and they drill a hole in your head, which...
And they're talking to you?
You sleep for the part where they drill a hole in your head.
That's
great. But then you go wake up, and they got to... Because they want to test how well you're reacting to the introduction of the wires into your head. So they ask you to do various tasks, like simple motions that would be part of any neurological exam. And they see how you're responding to that. And if you're not responding well, they will tune the operation a little bit so that you can do this better. In fact, I have on my website, it's off and on as the blog, I've got links to two different operations where people are actually playing musical instruments while they're being operated on.
Wow.
And so then the doctor's saying, well, how's your B flat there? And the guy goes, well, I think I need a little more ability to put some vibrato on that. And the guy's like, okay, try this. It's just amazing. One guy's a classical violinist, and he had not Parkinson's, but benign essential tremor, which is not the same thing. But he was able to return to his career as a violinist, which is amazing. And then the other guy was a banjo player, sort of a country banjo guy. This is in Nashville, actually, where the operation was done.
Pretty amazing.
It's just incredible. It's where physics and chemistry and electricity all sort of come together, biology as well. And they can sort of goose the electricity side and the physics side and the biology side, suddenly come along and say, we'll play ball.
Yeah.
It's just bizarre.
So you're still taking medication. So
yes.
You didn't find the experience like that other guy where they stopped the medication.
No, but I cut my medication in half. And that has led to a lot of good outcomes for me, because one of the problems with Parkinson's is the medications will eventually prove as problematic as the disease. In some ways, because, as we talked about earlier, you've got to take so much that it leads to wild over... You become kind of a Joe Cocker. You're like Joe Cocker. And sit around and sing goodbye, or goodbye with a little help from my friends all this time. And wave your arms around and shake your head and stuff. But if you can cut your medication down, you don't have that problem as much.
I see.
And that's one reason I'm able to speak to you and not wave back and forth in my seat as much as I have in the past.
Right. And this is the combination of the deep brain... electrode. And yep. That's implanted somewhere?
Well, the electrodes are implanted in my head. There's two holes.
But is there any kind of battery?
It's like a, like the implant that you would have if you're having a heart,
rhythmic.
Yeah.
What do they call that?
It's escaping me right now. It's probably brain stimulators. Zap that out of my head. Pacemaker.
Okay.
In fact, they call this operation the pacemaker for the brain. But instead of messing around with your heart, as if that wasn't daring and bold and sort of hubristic enough, they will mess with your brain.
Were you scared going in?
No, I wasn't scared because I had basically no options at that point. It was like, this is going to work or wasn't going to work. And I had tremendous confidence in my doctor, who was the kind of guy that will inspire tremendous confidence in you. He's very calm. And actually, he just has his first child was born not long before my operation. I said to his nurse, this isn't going to affect my operation. And she goes, no, it will not. It was like no question in her mind. This was not a problem for him. He could operate in his sleep or in someone else's sleep, I guess.
Or just after having a baby.
Yep. His wife had the baby, to be technical about it, but it was...
His wife had the baby,
He wasn't getting any sleep, I don't think.
Yeah. So how long does the operation take?
Well, it depends on who does it, because certain people will... This guy does it all in one fell swoop. He will drill both your brain holes and do both sides of your brain and install the pacemaker device all in one operation. So that takes about 8 hours, I believe. Although I was coming and going, so I don't know for sure how long it took. But other people will prefer to just do one side at a time, and that is, and then do the pacemaker part later. So that can take much longer.
Now, are there wires going down your neck, or how does it?
There's a, I don't know if you folks at home can see this, but there's actually a little thing in my chest, which runs up behind my ear, and then from there it runs into my head.
Sort of a little irrigation canal there.
Yeah, it's a little electrical irrigation.
Yeah. I'm just going to give the numbers out for folks who might want to call in and ask us any questions. It's 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752. And I'm going to just pitch this question to you that came in from our email from Heather. I understand that stem cell research has provided some promising therapies for Parkinson's, yet stem cell research remains controversial and largely unfunded by NIH. Can you comment?
Well, that's a big question. I think that there's certainly an ethical problem with stem cells and that some people have an ethical problem with it. But we'll leave that aside for now to talk about the efficaciousness of Parkinson's. There has been a number of attempts to make this work, and I'm not as optimistic about stem cells as I was in the past, because it appears that when the cells begin to grow, they're affected by the same process that affects your cells you already got there with Parkinson's. In other words, they're not able to cure the disease. They hope they're able to replace the missing cells, and there's possibly something they could do with that that would be helpful, I suppose. But they have a problem. They don't know how to turn them off. So the thing is, they put the new cells in, and they just don't shut up. And pretty soon you got that same problem that you have if you take too much medication, which is they're making too much.
I see. Dopamine. So they're still really, really at the early stages of understanding that.
So I think this may be good for people that have diabetes or other problems with their bodies. It can be solved by stem cells, but I'm not sure that it can be done with Parkinson's, but who knows? It's one of these things that, for instance, the surgery was the sort of thing that they kind of discovered by accident. So it's hard to say what makes science progress and where the progression is going to come from.
Right.
I will say I'm relieved that it's not considered anathema to at least look at them nowadays. That's certainly a step forward, because if we're not doing the experiments, we can't get anywhere.
Right, right. Just want to let our listeners know, if they've just joined Hometown Alaska, I'm Kathleen McCoy, and Peter Dunlap-Scholl is my guest today, a longtime political cartoonist in Alaska, talking about living with Parkinson's and the creative spurt that he's experienced since his diagnosis, which is really where I want to go next, Pete.
Okay.
I'd like to talk about what you've been doing since you left the Daily News, and in fact, you've got an art opening.
Yeah, I've got a thing I did. It's a great project. This person named Sarah Hurst wrote a comic book that is a history of Alaska, and she got a lot of different artists to illustrate it, and I'm one of the artists that illustrated it, so we'll have a opening for that. It's the A Native Lad is the name of the book. It's A Native Lad, Benny Benson Tells Alaska's Story. And so Sarah did a great job on doing the research, et cetera, for this, and she farmed out. She was so organized. She got a grant from the Humanities Forum to pay artists, which was unheard of. This was really great. She paid us. It's like, oh, wow.
That's great.
Actual money for this is
for what I love to do anyway.
Yeah, and what other people can't do for themselves, but they are reluctant to part with their hard-earned green to make that happen. But it was...
So this was telling this... Is it a graphic novel?
Yeah, it is, which is a term for anything that is a comic book that is... It's actually a term for an ambitious comic book, is what it is.
So you drew the pages, some of the pages.
Yeah, there was a number of scenes. I think there was maybe 15 scenes that she had. And so each artist was assigned a scene, and I got a couple extras because I'd been working for a newspaper, and I was very fast compared to other people.
Understood the concept of a deadline.
Yeah, well, it was one of the things that I was... I'd just been working so fast for so long that it was not fair. And so I got extra scenes because I was the first one at the finish line, apparently.
Uh-huh. So that art opening is at the International Gallery.
That should be the 3rd, I think it's December.
December 3rd.
Yep.
And it basically it's going to be a display of the artwork that went into the book.
Should be very fun because it's very nice artwork.
That's great.
It's fun because it's not just one person. It's like all these people. I was amazed at the talent she got. She got lots of great people to use it. People that I had no idea were around.
Well, sometimes getting paid really helps.
Yeah, it's one of the things, just wave a dollar bill around. Artists for sure will come out of nowhere and say, I got a use for that.
I can do that for you. And in addition to that art opening, I know you have a film that's been accepted into the Anchorage Film Festival. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that's been a project sort of near and dear to my heart. It's my sort of a memoir of my experiences during the 1964 Alaska earthquake when I was 5. And it was the sort of thing where the film is kind of about what are we afraid of and why are we afraid of it? Because I was, at that time, 5 and sort of a happy-go-lucky kid. And the earthquake came, and I thought it was a hoot. It was just great. We were sort of bouncing up and down. My brother and I were enjoying it because you could jump up in one spot and you come down in another spot. It was like the room would move underneath you. It was like walking on the moon or something like that. But meanwhile, 2 kids down the street were killed. So we're sitting there happily bouncing away and down the street. Another kid is being swallowed by the earth. It was very, when I got older, I looked back on that and thought, holy crap, that's amazing. And so this is a story that tells what it was like to be there and then what happened afterwards. And it's all, like 6 minutes is what the thing is. It's all animated. And that's been something I have just taken up the last 3 years or so, and I'm finally starting to get to work like I want it to work. So this, I think, is the best thing I've done in animation yet. And it's... Going to screen at the festival, I think, at Out North Theater on...
December 11th, yes. At 7:30. So I want to let our listeners know, too, that we have some of your video posted on our website, which is special videos you did about what it's like to live with Parkinson's. Mm-hmm. And, did you do those over the course of several years, or did you do those in preparation for something?
Well, it was just the sort of thing where I realized I was a guy that could make videos and that I had Parkinson's. I could explain Parkinson's a little bit if I made the videos, or what it was like to have Parkinson's, because there's lots of things that are technical about it. It doesn't have dopamine or whatever, but I think that a film is a great way to show people what's inside your head without having to drill holes in it like we did with the surgery. So that seemed like a good thing to do. So I did about 5 films, I think, that are on this theme. They're very short, but then I stuck them all together and they're now a 5-minute film, which is... Like monumental for me, that's...
Sort of like chapters.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I think there's one on diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. There's one on being under-medicated, which is a problem. And then there's one on being over-medicated, which is also a problem. And there's one on, I think the problem is speech, which I don't know if I include that in the omnibus edition there, but it's...
I'm not sure if it's in there.
I wouldn't say it's the strongest one, so it's probably left out is what I think.
There's one on...
Diagnosis.
Well, there's one on what it's like to have Parkinson's, which is you in a box with the sun outside and life outside the box. That one is very powerful.
Thank you.
Was that particularly strong for you, Pete?
Well, it's the way you feel sometimes is that Parkinson's interrupts your whole trajectory through life. It's like you're suddenly taken from this vital person who can do lots of stuff, ride your bike, play music, and all this stuff is going to be taken from you. And you just sort of feel like, actually, the thought I had when I had Parkinson's was, I'm going to be shut up in a room somewhere and not feel the sun. And that was tremendously depressing, actually. So that's sort of what that video is about, the idea of too many people with Parkinson's will often not interact with the rest of the world. And that's a mistake because you need that interaction to keep you from sliding even faster and farther down into the Parkinson's hole, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want to just shuffle out there and do your thing.
You know, I want you to tell people the story about the airport. You said you've had many big moments at airports, and one of them had to do with...
I'll tell you two stories about the airport. The first one was I was on a red eye, and I got off, and I could not for the life of me move. It was just like I was stuck big time, and I'd taken some medication, and there was a... I was the latent period where we're waiting for the medication to kick in, and then when it kicks in, you can move. Only I couldn't move when it was time for it to kick in. I was still stuck. I got very exasperated. I just decided I was going to walk backwards. So for some reason, the disease says, okay, you want to walk backwards? I give up. Go ahead, walk backwards. So I walked backwards all the way to the baggage claim from the gate. And my son and my wife covered for me. I sort of acted like I was in a very animated way, telling them it's a great story that I couldn't wait to tell them. I had to tell them I was walking or something like that. And then the second story about the airport is on this trip down to Seattle, I actually forgot my wallet and I had to get in a cab, go back to my house, get the wallet, go back in the cab, go back to the airport, run to the airport and get on the plane, which I was able to do thanks to the surgery now because I didn't have the problem anymore of freezing and excessive slowness. So that's before and after, I guess, we got there.
But, you know, I wondered about airports too because with all this gadget in your brain, can you go through?
No.
What do you do?
Got to get patted down.
You got to do the patting down.
Yeah, you get very intimate with somebody you don't even know.
How do you feel about that?
It's annoying, and it was especially annoying in this case because I was like, the departure had been announced, and I'm getting patted down, and the guy's like going as fast as he can, and I'm going, got a plane to catch here, dude, and he's going, I'm patting you down as fast as I can, is what he said. Or something along those lines. He's trying to balance the short-term rage of a person that wanted to get on an airplane with the long-term danger that I might be a person that was going to bring the whole thing down, I guess.
Well, listen, we have about a minute left, Pete, and I wanted, because I've known you forever as a political commentator about our state, and I just thought people would appreciate hearing a little bit from you about, you know, we just went through a pretty raucous U.S. Senate race, and in your life now, you've commented on it. But so what is it about Alaska that delivers such great political material?
I guess we've got people that think big and do big. It's like when Frank Murkowski was, I got diagnosed and then Frank Murkowski was mayor or governor and I had this incredible rich time with Frank. And then people said, when Frank goes, you're going to be in big trouble, aren't you? I said, no, something will come along. And lo and behold, it did.
All right. You know, thanks, Pete. I wish we had more time to talk about politics. But I just have to let folks know that Hometown Alaska will return after Thanksgiving. So next Wednesday, you're going to have the opportunity to listen to American as Pumpkin Pie, The History of Thanksgiving, A Search for the True Roots of Thanksgiving. Thanks to Kristen Spack, Hometown Alaska's engineer, with assistance from Constance Huff. I'm Kathleen McCoy. Happy holidays.
Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated News and Public Media. An archived copy of today's program, additional information, and links to all the websites mentioned on today's show are available online at kska.org. Send us your comments and suggestions of things you'd like to talk about at Hometown Alaska, 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. This is KSKA Anchorage.